Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Change Your Mind and Your Life Will Follow, 12 Simple Principles by Karen Casey, narrated by Devin Sorvery. A Preface Revisited. It's a bit mind-bending realizing that Change Your Mind and Your Life Will Follow was written a decade ago. I was sitting right where I am now, in our Minnesota lake home, pounding away on my Apple computer in the wee hours of the morning. I had a deadline that I was intended to make, and the ideas filled my mind as quickly as I was able to make space for them. The words tumbled forth, almost unnoticed by me, and the ideas kept coming. Gloriously, I sat among the ideas and the thousands of words, knowing without question that I was doing exactly what I was intended to do. That's been the beauty of my writing life, actually. I have never doubted that the God of my understanding had called me to attention as I sat before my computer. In fact, that God had first called me to attention in 1981, as I sat, not many miles from here, with pen and legal pad in hand, writing the words that were to become my first book. Each day, a new beginning. My God has kept me very busy over the years, listening and then writing the hundreds of thousands of words that have filled many books. I consider myself a lucky woman indeed. As I sit here, recalling the many pleasures as well as the struggles of my life, I am wholeheartedly convinced that I wouldn't change any single event. I believe that every one of them wore my name. Whomever I met, I know agreed to meet me. Whatever I learned was on the list I came here to sort out. Having this mindset gives me relief beyond measure. It has allowed me to trust that whatever remains of my life will be exactly as it is destined to be, and all who cross my path want to do so. We will meet because that has been our intention. We will learn that which we came here to learn. Reviewing this book you now listen to a full decade after it was first published pleases me, not only because of the message that I continue to feel committed to word for word, but because it has stood this brief test of time. I simply wouldn't change a word of this book, with the exception of updating the number of sober years I have had. And that seems remarkable, actually. Is it because I got the message so right the first time around, or because I trust that what was written then simply needed to be shared by me in that perfect time, and what I may need to share now will find its way onto the pages of another book? My journey with you, the reader, has been such a gift, one that I feel so blessed to have traveled, that we have been able to develop a friendship through this and perhaps other books of mine, too, has given my life such a rich purpose. We each have been purposefully born. I relish this truth, day in and day out. That it will pull me forward into my next pursuit allows my breath to freely escape between my softened lips. We are here by intention. We will be there with intention, too. May your every step be taken with as much assurance as your heart can hold, and may we meet repeatedly along this journey that has so lovingly called our names. Karen Casey, www.womens-spirituality.com. Introduction. My Journey. I am daughter number 3. 65 years ago, my father, against the doctor's advice, insisted that my mother get pregnant again. He wanted a son. My mother didn't want any more children. I can't be certain that I sensed her unhappiness about my impending birth while in the womb, but I think I did. A former therapist of mine thinks so, too. 2 years after I was born, there was a fourth child, a son. My dad rejoiced. My mom became even sadder. My earliest memories are of closely watching my parents' every move, trying to figure out if I was the cause of their unhappiness, of my dad's incessant rage, and my mother's sadness. Watching their faces for clues about how I should feel and behave became second nature to me, and I strenuously avoided eye contact with either of them. Most of the time, I was scared. At times, the fear was immobilizing. I spent many Sunday afternoons and evenings on the living room couch, sick to the point of vomiting because I had to go back to school on Monday mornings and face teachers who made me as fearful and uncomfortable as my parents did. My fear followed me throughout childhood and into adulthood, stomach aches and all. By the time I was in high school, the habits I had formed to deal with my anxiety, including escaping into a fantasy world, which I wrote about during spare moments, were well honed. I wanted to spend as little time as possible around my real family, so I lied about my age and got a job in a department store when I was barely 15. I went to work every day after school and on Saturdays, thus managing to greatly reduce the number of hours a week that I had to interact with my family. Unfortunately, this did nothing for my anxiety. Growing up, my siblings and I never talked about the near-constant fighting at our house. Sadly, we seldom talked to each other at all, so I never knew if the fighting triggered the same kind of fear in them. It seemed that each one of us more or less tiptoed around the house, trying to avoid my dad's wrath, without ever acknowledging that that was what we were doing. Perhaps our isolation from one another was our attempt to keep the fear from being real and overtaking us. Only in the last few years have my siblings and I broached the topic of the tension in our household. Since no two people ever share the same perceptions in troubled families, it's perhaps not surprising that no one seems to recall it as vividly as I do. One sister hardly recalls it at all. Throughout high school, even though I was a member of the in-group, I always felt slightly separate. I often tried to read the faces of my friends to see how well I was liked, as had been my steady habit in my family. I am quite certain that none of my friends realized how insecure I felt. I certainly never voiced my fears. I didn't need to. By age 15, I had discovered the perfect anxiety reducer: alcohol. My drinking was alcoholic from the start. I didn't get drunk every day, of course. It was not until I was married that I started drinking every day. But I did feel an immediate sense of well-being every time I drank, and I loved the freedom from fear that alcohol offered me. My love of alcohol didn't elicit reprimands or even a glance from my parents. They drank too, as did all of their friends, as well as their siblings. It was easy to indulge without drawing attention to myself. And luckily for me, there were frequent family gatherings where I managed to meld into the woodwork with a drink in one hand and a stolen cigarette in the other. In 1957, I reluctantly entered college with just one purpose in mind: to find a husband who wanted to party. I had not actually put words to my intent, but it was evident to anyone who watched. And I succeeded. My first marriage, which began while we were seniors at Purdue University, quite surprisingly lasted 12 years. Alcohol was first the glue, and then the poison. We had not set out to hurt one another, but we did, over and over again. Long before the marriage ended, we moved to Minnesota in order for my husband to attend graduate school. The pain of our lives escalated because of the alcohol and my husband's infidelities. By the time we divorced, my alcoholism was out of control, but I was miraculously mastering the art of attending graduate school myself. With hindsight, I marvel at how easily I moved through my PhD program. I certainly had not come to Minnesota with any plan to pursue a graduate degree, but alcohol fueled my confidence. And with nothing better to do and no real plan for my life, I enrolled. I am certain that had I not been drinking at the time, I would not have attempted graduate school. I had been an elementary school teacher for 8 years in Indiana and Minnesota and doubted that I was smart enough to do anything else. No one was more surprised than I when I began accumulating A's, but my fears still controlled me. I had not escaped my need for constant attention and affirmation from others, particularly men. It's fortunate that drinking finally quit doing for me what I needed it to do. By giving up alcohol and other drugs in 1976, I was able to salvage a life that was literally headed for a dead end. Getting sober has made me profoundly aware that there are no accidents. Where we are, where I am right now, is intentional. The same can be said for you, of course. The development of this perspective evolved over a number of years. Years spent not only in the exploration of numerous spiritual pathways, but also in an attempt to listen to the inner voice, which I believe to be the source of all knowledge. This perspective, that everything we need to know lies within us, has explained and eased every aspect of my life. It has informed my decisions. It has led me to write and publish 16 books in 20 years. The book you are now listening to reveals another, deeper layer to this belief in the power of perspective. It is claimed that Abe Lincoln once said, "We are as happy as we make up our minds to be." I like this idea. It simplifies our assignment. We can have better lives if we make up our minds to do so. The choice is ours. Wherever we go, there we are, as the people we have decided to be. We decide. That's the revelation. We decide if we are going to live lives that are bitter or sweet. We decide, in every moment, to respond from peace or from fear. We decide. The truth is, it doesn't take very much effort to make our lives sweeter. It does take willingness, though, willingness to make tiny shifts in how we perceive our experiences and our fellow travelers. Instead of perceiving everyone and everything as a potential threat or obstacle, we can choose to approach each moment as an opportunity to be peaceful. And each time we choose the peaceful response, we are paving the way not only for our own happiness, but for a peaceful world as well. In this book, I will teach you the 12 principles that can help us manifest a peaceful world. Just 12 simple principles to practice. That's all. Won't you join me? 1. Tend your own garden. It's easy to make other people the focus of our attention, isn't it? Women especially are raised to do so. We judge. We criticize, sometimes audibly, through anger, manipulation, shame, or guilt. We try to control the people sharing our journey. I have news for you. These are always the wrong choices, and never the work we have been called to do. Focusing outside ourselves and attempting to control other people is a clever avoidance technique. Temporarily, at least, it helps us escape having to look at our own, sometimes troubling, behavior. The irony is that we always see in others the very behaviors that we need to pay some attention to in ourselves. Always. The people in our lives, family and friends, neighbors, even the strangers at the grocery or ahead of us in the traffic jam, are mirrors that reveal who we are. Our reactions to them show us what we need to work on in ourselves, and as we release them to live their own lives, we can get back to the business of controlling the only thing we really can control, our own responses to life. Okay, but how? Simple. We have to learn some new behaviors and then practice them. Cultivating new behaviors. Attend to your life. No one else's. Many of us acquired the habit of interfering in other people's affairs early on in life. We heard our parents speaking critically about their friends or other family members or neighbors for their actions or opinions. Obsessively watching the behavior of friends, family, or even complete strangers and longing to change or control their behavior is a great catalyst for inner turmoil. This goes hand in hand with the misguided idea that we can change anyone but ourselves. You can spend years trying to change a spouse or some other friend, but what a relief to finally learn that the affairs of others are not ours to control or even to judge. Being in charge of ourselves is enough. It bears repeating. We are not in charge of others, not their behavior, their thoughts, their dreams, their problems, their successes, or their failures. Even the children we parent have their own journey to make, and our so-called control over them is, in fact, an illusion. We can set an example for them, we can suggest a set of behaviors, we can demonstrate a code of ethics, we can even require that they live by certain house rules while under our roof. But finally, it is they who will decide who they want to be and what they want to do, regardless of our efforts. And for that, we will become grateful in time. I say, let's celebrate the fact that we are in charge of no one but ourselves. It relieves us of a heavy burden and a thankless job, one that never blesses us. Taking control of every thought we have and every action we take, and being willing to relinquish the past while savoring the present, will assuredly keep us as busy as we need to be. Doing these things, and only these things, is why we are here. It's only when we live our own lives and manage our own affairs, freeing others to do the same, that we will find the peace we seek and so deserve. Let go and let others be themselves. So many of us spend countless hours or weeks, or in some sad cases, years, trying to make someone be who we want them to be or do what we think is in their own, or perhaps our, best interests, only to repeatedly fail in our attempts. This is a tragedy as well as a misspent life. It's time to let go. I was first introduced to the idea of letting go in a 12-step support group, and I was very slow to grasp the meaning. Wasn't it my job to guide a loved one's decisions and actions, to control them if I could? I had always thought that not doing so was selfish and uncaring. Thankfully, what I finally learned was that our spouses, our friends, our family, our neighbors, even the strangers crossing our paths must be who they are, not who we think they should be. They must make their own mistakes and, through what they learn, have reason to celebrate their own successes. There are many reasons for letting go of this futile behavior, but the most important ones are that we will never succeed in controlling others and never experience peace in our own lives if we are always focused on how other people are living or how we think they should be living. If we want to be peaceful, we must let go of how others choose to live and take care of business in one life only, our own. Get out of the center of other people's lives. Just as no one else can productively or peacefully be the total focus of our lives, we cannot waste precious time thinking we are or should be the center of someone else's life either. That may come as a blow to your ego, but it's time to learn this important truth. This does not mean we should quit interacting with people or shut them out in order to preempt being shut out, nor does it mean we should ignore how other people are thinking and behaving for fear we will seek an unhealthy dependency on them. Observing others can be both edifying and enlightening. It simply means getting perspective on our role in all interactions and understanding where our responsibility for action ends and the other person's begins. Becoming entangled in other people's actions, dreams, or dramas binds us to them in emotionally unhealthy ways and prevents the growth we deserve. Unfortunately, many of us mistake being enmeshed for feeling safe. We want people around us who will pay us constant attention, who will make no plans that don't include us, have no thoughts that aren't shared. But that's not relationship. That's dependence. It is unholy connection. Relationships that truly bring us to peace are interdependent. They allow us to connect while still living and honoring our own lives and letting our learning partners do the same. Take no hostages. Many of us think our most meaningful work has to do with minding other people's business. Why is it so hard to let other people have their own journey? Why do we persist in interfering in other people's lives, especially when we reap so few benefits? Because our parents did is not reason enough. We no doubt observed our parents doing many things that we have chosen to avoid. No, there must be another reason. After nearly 3 decades of emotional and spiritual growth through 12-step programs and other spiritual pathways, I have concluded that we mind other people's business, we take hostages, so to speak, strictly out of our own insecurity. We get personally invested in other people and the outcomes of their actions because we see those outcomes as defining our lives in some way, as taking from us or adding to us some heretofore unrealized value. How sad that we perceive our own well-being as so tied to the decisions, even occasional whims, of others. But we do it again and again, and our lives are never better for it, at least in the long run. In the short run, trying to help a loved one live his or her life may seem like the right thing to do. It may even be engaging for a while. But taking care of our own lives is as much work as any one of us needs to experience. The work of someone else's life belongs to that person and God. In fact, thinking of God, if even just occasionally, in the midst of all our experiences, those that involve others and those that involve us alone, can change our perspective entirely. No experience is mystifying for long if we remember who is orchestrating it. It is important to remember, of course, that accepting that God is in charge of everyone's life doesn't mean we have nothing to do. Indeed, footwork, some seemingly trivial and some quite specific and elaborate, is always necessary. We must be accountable in our own lives, moment by moment, and demonstrate this by doing the next right thing. But God is ever present to guide us and everyone else, too. Never is any one of us out of his or her range. 2. Stop focusing on problems so their solutions can emerge. Lots of folks think that they need to attack their problems in order to resolve them. They will study a problem, analyze it from myriad angles, troubleshoot it, utilize so-called problem-solving techniques that may have appeared successful before, without realizing that within every problem lies its solution. That's right. Problems are only as big and as real as we make them. In fact, they only exist if we allow our egos to create them, and then we feed them through our incessant attention. Take a look at the following suggestions for changing how you look at the imagined problems in your life, and never doubt that by changing your mind, you can change every experience in your life. Cultivating new behaviors. Quit making a big deal out of ordinary situations. Okay, sounds good, but what's an ordinary situation? Being placed on interminable hold while trying to find out why a package has not arrived, for example, seeking help when your computer crashes in the middle of a project for work, dealing with a house remodeling project that is woefully behind schedule and the workmen have failed to make an appearance for more than a week, getting in the wrong line at the grocery, the one where the 3 people ahead of you forgot an item and had to run back to get it, causing you to be late to meet a friend, or to pick up your child from daycare. And let's not forget the traffic jam, particularly when you are already running late. All of these extremely ordinary situations can become big problems if we let them, but we don't have to let them. The only real problem situations are the ones that place our lives in jeopardy, and even those might be perceived as opportunities for new growth. I remember a very wise man I taught with at the University of Minnesota saying that he used every traffic jam as an opportunity to pray for all of the people in all of the cars ahead of him. He said it immediately changed how he felt. He also had the feeling that his prayers helped loosen up traffic, too. One can never know if that's objectively true, but simply feeling better from taking an action like prayer whenever one experiences a problem makes doing it worthwhile. Prayer certainly never hurts a situation or a person. Quite the contrary. Let's make the decision to joyfully accept all situations, the lines, the traffic jams, the downed computers, and the rest, as opportunities to include God in our lives, in that moment, and then wait for the change in perception that will assuredly come. Our lives change when our perceptions change. This is an absolute that we can count on. Stop overreacting. Many years ago, as I was finishing up in the PhD program at the University of Minnesota, I had a really frightening experience that taught me something about overreacting. All I needed was to get my dissertation approved by all five professors who sat on my committee. Four of the members approved it in a timely fashion. The fifth professor dragged his feet. Naturally, I assumed he was not going to approve it, but I couldn't even get him to make an appointment with me. My dissertation advisor suggested I set a date for my orals anyway. I did, and then pleaded with the holdout to meet with me. He finally agreed, and I went to his office, a bit fearful, but hopeful. His first words were, "This has got to be rewritten." I was stunned and terrified. I sat quite still for a moment, trying to collect my thoughts, which were bouncing from one scary scenario to another. I wanted to scream, call him horrible names, and run from his office. I wanted to shame him, since four of his colleagues had already approved my work in glowing terms and within the appropriate timeline. But before saying anything, I took a deep breath, and then a miracle occurred. Some force within me took over my thoughts, and I quietly suggested to him that we review his objections together. I was not sure where those words came from. Only moments before, I had wanted to scream obscenities and run. But I remained calm. I didn't overreact. In fact, I didn't even react. I simply responded to his attack calmly. What happened next was that we went through every one of his concerns in the 300-page dissertation, and I addressed each one with explanations I didn't even actually hear. I could never have repeated them, nor could I tell my husband one word I had said when I got home. It felt like an out-of-body experience. I watched myself explain away his criticisms, and 3.5 hours later, he approved my work in glowing terms. I left his office exhilarated, but very confused. I knew I didn't know how to answer his questions, but somewhere within me, the answers did reside. Had I fallen back on old habits and overreacted to his charge, I might never have received my degree. But I learned two important things from this experience that were, in fact, worth more than the PhD. One, I learned that remaining calm can help defuse a situation and feelings of terror. And two, I learned that I had the capability to listen to an inner wisdom if I chose to. I have never forgotten the feeling I had when I left his office, nor have I ever forgotten that our answers are always within. What I have forgotten far too many times, though, is to turn to that source when I most need it. Making the decision to give up overreacting will ensure us of far smoother relations with others. It will pave the way for a peacefulness we may not have experienced except on rare occasions in the past, and it will open the door to the wisdom that lies within each of us. And if we can't give up our habit of overreacting in every situation, stopping ourselves from overreacting even once a day will impact our lives and all of our...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?